Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to another episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and my co-host from the Inland Ocean Coalition is the ever-gregarious Vicki Nichols Goldstein.
Thank you so much, David, and welcome everyone.
And at the time of this recording, the government's still shut down, so we'll skip blue news you can use, except to note that when President Trump threatens to lay off thousands more federal workers from what he calls Democrat agencies, that can't be good news for the folks doing vital work for the nation at NOAA or the EPA. Of course, the Coast Guard's still out there on patrol. So today we're thrilled to be talking with Chef Andrew Zimmern, the award-winning host and producer of several popular radio and TV shows, including the Food Channel's Bizarre Foods that I got to join him on when he cruised the culinary coast of California. Also, What's Eating America, and the recent, I'll say amazing, PBS Hope in the Water documentary series. He's been working with the food we eat since he was 14. He's written a number of books, including the upcoming Blue Food Cookbook with our old friend Barton Seaver, along with his James Beard Awards and many activities. Andrew's a founding member of the Coalition for Sustainable Aquaculture, so lots to cover. But Andrew, we usually start with our guests by asking their first connections with the sea. Was that working at the Quiet Clam in East Hampton?
No, I was born in July of 1961. My mother left the hospital with me swaddled in clothed in baby gear, whatever it was at the time, maybe just a blanket. And that afternoon, after she left the hospital, I was immediately taken to the beach near our house in Long Island and dipped into the Atlantic Ocean.
Oh, wow.
We loved collecting food outdoors. We didn't call it foraging. We didn't call it anything. My parents called it fun. We dug for clams anytime we needed them in the bay. We always kept a Ziploc bag of rotten chicken legs in the freezer, or I guess a Glad baggie at that point, and throw it on a string out into Georgica Pond and slowly pull the string. And then someone would come with a big net and swoop up 10, 12, 14 blue crabs. My dad would surf cast every time we went to the beach. We would pull ropes of mussels from the jetties. He would hold me by my ankles and lower me down. And then we would cook it on the beach at 4 or 5 o'clock. He'd build a fire, and we kept a grill grate. He hid stones. We kept a grill grate and stones in the dunes because no one took your stuff in those days. And so it was really an easy kind of thing. And we loved to fish. As a little kid, I went eeling in Two Mile Harbor. This was just part of growing up as a young kid in the summer in Long Island in the 60s. And we ate fish all the time. Local bluefish was really cheap. And my mother baked it in what I now know to be a very Portuguese style of baking fish, with lots of onions and tomatoes and peppers. She didn't make a sofrito to start with. She just loaded everything together and kind of sheet panned the deal into the oven. We would eat that 2 or 3 times a week. We would get little porgies and small bass from the men who were pulling fishing boats up at the beach early in the morning, or go to their little fish store where the family that operated the boats would sell their stuff. I didn't know that they were types of fish that no one else really ate. They weren't catching salmon and halibut and shrimp and tuna. They were catching small bass, stripers, bluefish, porgies, blowfish, weakfish.
Weakfish. I grew up fishing with my grandpa right in that same
Weakfish couvillon in the book. That's one of my favorites. But the point is that these are all fish that people are pretty unfamiliar with now, and you don't see them a lot in seafood markets, except smaller ones in coastal communities. So I was already baptized in the lore of the ocean, and my parents were very, very vocal with me that this way of living was disappearing, because that's what they were hearing from the families that operated the fishing stores and ran the fishing boats. And my dad and I would hear it when we go out to Montauk and go fishing. I once asked him, actually, I was like 7 or 8 years old. We were going out to catch striped bass with a friend on their boat. And we saw this monstrous 300-400 pound tuna being lifted by a small crane off of a boat and into the back of a truck, a commercial truck. And I asked my dad, what was that? It was the biggest fish I'd ever seen. And he said, yeah, it's a bluefin tuna. And I asked him where it was going. And he said, probably mid-island to be processed for cat food. Oh. That's what was happening in the 60s with tuna. There wasn't a market in America in the 60s for fresh tuna. I mean, think about that. That's just how the culture and the dining room table has turned just in 2.5 generations.
So do you, after having all of this experience and eating from the beach and from the sea, did you go on to get any kind of formal training, or did you just figure it out?
In the late 70s, I went to visit the campus at CIA.
CIA being Culinary Institute of America.
In Hyde Park. And they were still teaching how to break down a chicken really from a cutting board. It wasn't taught the way it's taught today. International foods were taught during a week-long section, and that was usually like a Chinese wok dish. And old European chefs teaching students how to cook old European food. By the time I was of age to go into a cooking school environment, I'd been around the world 3 times with my father. I knew the kitchens I wanted to work in. And so I went to Italy and to France and to Hong Kong and worked in restaurants, as taking time off from college to do it, because that was the thing. It's kind of like, I have some musician friends and we talk about this all the time. If you want to be a rock star, play in your garage with your friends. If you're talented, you wind up getting to be at the big kids' table, the music business. And I think it's the same thing with food. Go practice the craft of cooking, standing shoulder by shoulder with other people who understand the craft of cooking and execute that way and practice the craft.
When was it that you transitioned from preparing and serving food to educating people about food?
I was in a restaurant that I was a partner in the late 90s, and I have always been a storyteller. I told stories through food. I also told stories by writing and talking. When I moved to the Twin Cities, I brought in live eels from the East Coast. We had the first oyster bar in Minnesota in our restaurant, first razor clam served here, the long list of seafood items that no one had ever brought into the Twin Cities before. None of it sold. And so I would be out there because I wanted to tell people about the Quinault Indians and their harvesting of these amazing razor clams. I put steamers on the menu in August. We flew them in from Maine. No one here knew how to deal with them. And it was a real stupid move on my part. It was all about ego and all the rest of it. But I realized I wanted to tell stories. And in telling those stories, I realized I needed a bigger audience. So I started doing TV and working in magazine and working a local TV station. And eventually I left the restaurant partnership and devoted myself full time to the food media.
So when you were telling stories, were you trying to incorporate sustainable seafood or indigenous or small-scale fisheries? What was the core of the stories you wanted to share?
The topics were different at the time. Those really hadn't come to the forefront as powerfully as they have over the last 15, 20 years. In the 90s, the restaurant that we had opened up in May of 1992, I was talking about, you know, economic issues, supporting small fisheries, eating seafood for health reasons. There was a lot more information starting to come about how bad commodity beef, chicken, and pork was, even though we weren't buying that for the restaurant. We were buying from farmers. It was about supporting fishermen was the big issue for me at the time. And the secondary issue was diversifying our food lives. If we're just eating the same things all the time, that seemed to me, and we didn't use the word unsustainable. Now, over the course of the next 15, 20 years, talking from 95 onward, for me, all those issues that you talked about began to get folded in to the conversation.
So you were sort of the first, I guess, fresh seafood restaurant in Minneapolis.
We didn't have a seafood restaurant. It was a French bistro, but we had a lot of specials. And with fish, one of the things that we did was there was the catch of the day. We always had a salmon on the menu, which is actually how I met one of my co-conspirators on Hope in the Water, the television series, who was working for an aquaculture company and sent me a salmon 15, 16 years ago. I had never had a passion for aquaculture. There were more people doing it wrong than doing it right. But I got this salmon and we cooked it off and I was like, wow, this is a lot better than it.
Other farm fish.
In the past.
Yeah.
And every year for a couple of years, I kept getting salmon from this woman, Jennifer Bushman. She was sending me farm salmon because I was on television. And eventually I got some that was really, really, really good and wound up going to a bunch of different salmon farms around the world and seeing how it was done in Scandinavia and in South America the right way. And I was really, really, really jazzed about it. And it really lit a fire underneath me about aquaculture being the solution that we needed to feed a hungry planet.
Now, to be clear, a lot of the early aquaculture in the 90s in terms of high dollar value fish like salmon and shrimp was not being done right.
Oh, no, not at all. As a matter of fact, over the course of my years visiting farms and stuff, the changes were magnificent, but they were also obvious. They used copper netting to start. It was oxidizing and harming the water, right? Okay, so now let's get that copper netting out. They had 3 to 5 fish per cubic meter in the water. Okay, that causes a lot of damage to the fish during harvest, damage when feeding. You actually have greater amount of salmon by pound getting on the customer's plate if you reduce the volume of fish in the water. So it went down to 2 or 3 per cubic yard.
Right. Less crowding means less lice, less antibiotics.
Andrew, I just wanted to ask you why we're talking about salmon, because we're going to have many listeners and you're using some concepts. But if you were a consumer and you wanted to buy sustainable, healthy salmon, what are some of the criteria that you would suggest? Because people would not necessarily know how big the pens were and how many salmon were in the pen.
Well, back then I was eating salmon seasonally, the same way that I ate tomatoes seasonally. And I ate tomato mozzarella salads every day when tomatoes were ripe, or some version of that. And then I didn't eat another one till spring or summer rolled around. And I had the opportunity to get vine-ripened good tomatoes from southern farmers at first, then local ones here in Minnesota. Eating cyclically gave me that desire. I mean, at the end of the summer, I mean, right now, I could be of a tomato mozzarella salad. But in June, it's the first thing I want to eat when those southern tomatoes show up in Minnesota markets. And it was the same thing with fish. Salmon was a spring and summer and sometimes into early fall, because you had different species,
starting runs,
and then
different wild fish,
sockeyes later on was wonderful, and you would treat them different ways because they had much different fat content. Farmed salmon in those days was mushy and fatty and didn't taste right to me and didn't have good mouthfeel and had a lot of problems. So nowadays there are really great salmon options. My goal is to see greater investment in what works, like aquaculture, so that we're not paying $40 a pound for farm salmon from New Zealand. If we invest in aquaculture and scale it properly, especially in our oceans, we can both protect our waters and produce out of them at the same time and feed a hungry planet.
The UN last year reported that for the first time in human history, we're producing more seafood from aquaculture than from wild harvest. And you understand that more than most people, what that means. Maybe you could just talk about that shift that's taking place now at a planetary level.
I would remind people, I've never been in a supermarket and heard someone behind me ask a worker there, excuse me, can you point me to where the wild chickens are? Right? We have domesticated these animals that feed us. Now, there's a lot of problems that come with them. I mean, we're tearing down more land every single day to grow food to feed these animals. So I'd like to see people eating less beef, pork, chicken. I surely am. And I'd like to see people eating a greater variety of beans and farinaceous foods and sustainable seafood. If we can eat more sustainable seafood each week, even one meal a week, I think, and the numbers prove it out, we would revolutionize not only our health and wellness, better for you, but we would be investing in safe and sustainable food systems.
Define what you mean by sustainable seafood so everyone can be on the same page.
Is it neutral or improving to our environment? Is it economically sustainable? Will it pay bills and reward people up and down the supply chain? If it doesn't, then you have an economic sustainability problem because it will work for a short amount of time but cannot provide solutions longer term, right? So you also have economic sustainability. There's cultural sustainability. So there's all types of sustainability. In general, the biggest thing that I could pass on to people is that if it damages our water, if it damages the system of human beings that are producing it, if it is produced in a way that causes more problems than it creates, it's not sustainable.
What is Rising Tide? Rising Tide is Blue Frontier's bi-weekly half-hour show that features a diversity of ocean voices from the famous to the fascinating, deep sea explorers to whale wranglers, Arctic residents to climate justice warriors. With public broadcasting under attack, Blue Frontier offers Rising Tide and all associated content for free to community and public radio stations across the nation. We need your support to keep producing our salty, in-depth conversations. A tax-deductible donation at bluefront.org will help us keep getting the word out about our awesome blue planet. And now, back to the show.
The reason we wrote the book we wrote the book for many reasons, but one of the biggest was to make sure that people understood that there's so much confusing mythology out there around food from the water that we wanted to write a compendium that would educate people how to ask for it, persuading people that asking questions is of vital importance when you're shopping for anything or eating anything out in a restaurant. I tell people all the time, if someone can't tell you where your food is from, don't eat it.
And this Blue Food Cookbook, which is a compendium to Hope in the Water series, is really about not just sustainable, but delicious and economically viable foods that people mostly don't think about. When you tell somebody to eat lower on the food chain, they think you're telling them to like have less flavor. So what's delicious and sustainable? And maybe talk a little bit about your cookbook.
It's just like any other cookbook. It's got delicious recipes and all up and down that food chain from small to big. And obviously, if you don't have weak fish to make weak fish couvillon, but you have, you know, a sustainable piece of snapper or grouper or tilapia or whatever, just go ahead and substitute the fish. It's okay to do that. And we talk about that a lot. You're better off eating something that's fresh and delicious for your family than writing a recipe ingredient down and saying, well, I'm not going to make this because that one ingredient wasn't in the market today. The bonus for the book to me is 100 plus pages of information about buying, shopping, storing, freezing, and debunking the myths. Not all seafood is expensive. Frozen is just fine. Is there bad frozen fish? Sure, there's bad frozen chicken too. But We freeze food all the time. And so we had it, you know, this volume is a very important book for that reason, because most seafood books are not great sellers. And every decade or so, a publisher takes a big swing, and we were told, this is it. We believe in this book because not only of the recipes, but the other 100 pages in there that tell people what to do and how to do it, and will make a difference for people, not just at their dining room table, but with their lifestyle, with their health and wellness.
Looking at your cookbook, it looks fantastic, and it's almost like the guide to eating sustainably. But I'm just curious, as a storyteller, if there was something that you put in that book that was really would be inspiring to others with that health, ocean health and storytelling
component. Like one good eat that helps the ocean.
One of the things that I found absolutely fantastic, and I would like to see every country in the world adopt this, was there's a calculus that the government of Chile imposed on salmon farmers down there. They said, this is great. Your nets have to be right. Your feeding system has to be right. The amount of fish in the water, all those things we talked about earlier, everything's got to be right. But when we give you this license to grow the salmon at sea, for every metric ton you take out, whatever X number of cubic meters that are in the water, you have to put 10 rows of columnar farming, starting with a float at the top and moving down with bags of mussels, clams, oysters, and seaweed, which all can grow on the same rope line going 40, 50 feet down into the water. The reason being, the seaweed sequesters all of that CO2. The more so than a tree in some cases. The oysters and clams and mussels are ideal foods, right, for human consumption, but they're filter feeders. Over the course of their shorter lives, they filter millions of gallons of water through their systems, and then eventually we eat them. They don't hold on to those. They're not sequestering forever chemicals. I don't want to give people the wrong point here, but those animals are miraculous for keeping our ocean clean. There's a double offset that's positive with laws that we have in Chile that could be adopted elsewhere, so that these companies who are using aquaculture systems, and I believe we need more of them and more investment in aquaculture, are also doing their fair share to improve the water. And they would like that too, because they want the water to sustain their business for generations to come.
And it's an integrated system where the shellfish are taking the nutrients that the fish are pooting out into the water, and then the seaweeds, the kelp, is taking out the carbon dioxide that would otherwise undermine the shells of the shellfish through ocean acidification. So everything's helping everything else. Your high dollar value pays for your middle value of the shellfish and your low value product with the kelp, which is still also delicious as seaweed salad.
And I'll tell you what else it does. When you have businesses at sea and these columnar farming beds offshore, they own the land there the same way fishermen have owned the land where they push out from, right? Sometimes in co-op fashion, sometimes working for a different company. Sometimes an enterprising entrepreneur buys a piece of land and throws some commercial dockage out and lets fishermen put their boats there. We need more of that. We need to preserve it, because that land is so valuable now. People are forced to sell as seafood is, we didn't talk about the percentage. 75% of all the seafood that comes in on American boats is exported away, and they're making less and less money every year. We need to be eating more seafood to support them, because it also keeps our coastline free and clear of giant hotels, mega mansions, and all the other stuff. We at a certain point, 8-9 years ago, I saw a study that said if we don't start to preserve our coastline, more doggedly, we are literally going to have homes ringing our coastline, which is really nice for the 10th of 1%ers that can afford it. However, from a groupthink perspective, nothing could be worse for us culturally. We need to have fishermen setting out to sea. We need to have ocean farms. We need to have access to this water because it is vital to the existence of our species as we move forward over the next 10, 20 years.
And this is just what we've been saying, which is working waterfronts are another endangered species. We need to protect the places where mariners and fishermen and women and the people who make a living from the sea can afford to live.
Yeah, it's really supporting our blue economy, the blue foods that you're talking about, and really having a good balance between the two.
Yeah, it's of vital importance. The people don't understand how interrelated everything is in this world. I get it. Life is tough for so many Americans, the vast majority of Americans. I have a platform. I have time to examine the issues. If I'm not putting that information out there, then I worry people aren't going to connect the dots and understand that you actually can be voting for a healthier planet and a healthier American economy simply by eating one seafood meal more a week.
So when can people get the Blue Food Cookbook? When's it come out?
Well, they can order it right now. Just go to andrewzimmern.com and there's a little pop-up window and it will take you to several different resources to pre-order it. The book drops on October 28th, but you can buy it now in four or five different ways. I encourage people to buy it now. There's no need to wait. Hit that link, buy the book. It comes to you overnight.
Andrew, this has been a wonderful interview, and thank you for sharing the whole blue economy, blue ocean, your childhood, and ways that we can eat and cook sustainably. So thank you, Chef Andrew Zimmern, for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helbart and me, Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier. Off in the salty ocean, off to the blue frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky, there you are. Good boy, Sparky.